Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browder. She is Marjorie Regan. Everyone thought that that daredevil, Nick Wallenda, was crazy to walk across a high wire 600 feet in the air above the Chicago River, blindfolded, by the way, without a net. What can seem just as terrifying? How about quitting your job with no backup plan? Well, it turns out it's what a lot of people in their 20s and 30s are doing. It may seem risky to other generations, but apparently not to millennials. Here with us in Studio 3 to talk about jumping from one job to the next without a safety net is Nancy Kane. Nancy, as you know, is an historian at the Harvard Business School, where she holds the James E. Robeson Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book, Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. Hey there, Nancy.
Hey there.
So I guess the bottom line here of this idea is that the millennials and 20-somethings, 30-somethings are the Nick Wallendas of the job market, Nancy Kane. Is that correct?
I think that might just be a wee bit of a stretch. Just a wee bit of a stretch. So the story or this subject, which is, you know, on the hearts, in the hearts and minds of lots of folks looking for work, not just millennials and not just their parents, right? Because, you know, some sizable portion of folks that are born after 1981 are living at home if they're in between jobs, or living at home if they're trying to save money or pay off college loans. It's also a big deal for lots of people looking to find work in an economy that is growing in very, very uneven ways, right? Where there's lots of macro growth right now, but it's in uneven ways and it's rewarding people very unevenly. So the article that we're talking about is an article from the New York Times from November 8th by Hannah Seligson about, you know, kind of taking the leap and switching jobs. And she talks about she's 32 or 34, and she and her husband is roughly the same age. And he quit his job in Washington with the federal government to go to New York without having another job. And then she goes to a number of different people, all in their late 20s or early 30s, who decided to either lost their job and decided not necessarily to look for another job right away because they had a gap and they wanted to reconsider. Mm-hmm. They wanted the gap to reconsider. Or people that got downsized, Working Woman, the magazine, that got downsized and, you know, reset and rebooted herself and decided to form her own business. And the point of the article
is... wait a second. Or there's a third who weren't downsized, who weren't laid off, right, who just decided it's time for
Time.
I need what is called a career interlude to figure out what I'm doing.
Right. So career interlude.
I love that expression.
Right. So the point of the article is really a rumination on new attitudes toward work. But it opens the door on a broader subject, which is, one, the frequency with which younger people now switch jobs. There's an interesting Department of Labor statistic that workers between the ages of 18 and 26 hold 6.2 jobs on average. That's a lot.
That's huge.
A lot. Well, if you start thinking about your own experience working during college and, you know, the last years of high school, it seems a little less, you know, out there. But that then leads into this broader set of numbers and observations. Columnists, sociologists, labor and work consultants checking in on what the future highway is for work and careers for people now in their 20s and early 30s. And there's a lot of hand-wringing and doom and gloom. One interesting article from Forbes.com or Forbeswoman.com was published on August 30th, 2012. Careers are dead. Welcome to your low-wage temp work future.
Yeah.
Right? Striking an optimistic tone about what this writer calls a disposable workforce. And then secondly, the idea that in a world in which the social contract, and we've talked about this on the show before, you folks, you and Jim and Marjorie have talked about it a lot in more general ways, that in the workforce and in a job situation or job environment in which the social contract of working for one company for a long time and, you know, and then collecting retirement is over and broken and not yet replaced by something that has any resemblance to that, we're all going to have to do a lot of reinvention. And so the general subject about the future of work for young people, older people, right, folks now in their late 50s and early 60s and even into their 70s, because lots of people are working into their 70s, is a fascinating, important topic. As a historian, once again, I don't see anything completely new under the sun. I mean, at the beginning of industrialization in the late 19th century, all kinds of people started on the farm, you know, took a career gap to move to the city, you know, started in stenography pools and worked their way up often, right? Or started on the floor of Marshall Field selling scarves and hats to other Chicago women and worked their way up to be department head. And so So the history of work is actually a history in which the more common occurrence or more common equilibrium is of people constantly reinventing themselves over a lifetime, less about career, more about lots of different jobs. And where the exception is actually what we've known over the last 60 years, which is, you know, you go to work, you sign up with a company, you sign up with a couple of companies, and you build a career in that institutional frame.
Well, let me tell you, I come at this in a from the same place, but then take it in a slightly different direction. When I'm reading this piece that this woman wrote in the New York Times, Hannah Seligson, right? My apologies. I thought she was leaving one thing out, and then she didn't. Near the end, I was going to say, what are employers going to think about this? While the conventional wisdom is that employers like to see consistency, she writes, the ability to reinvent oneself as gaining currency is a sought-after talent. The analogy I made to this, both my kids took gap years. Mm-hmm. Gap years used to be anathema.
Yeah, right.
God, you're never going to go back to school. You don't really care about education. Now gap years, while not quite the norm, are growing. And in fact, as you know, Nancy Kane, you know, Marjorie, a ton of universities are encouraging gap years so you get your act together. This, to me, this career interlude thing, to use the term this writer uses, it seems to me is a variation on the theme. And what it basically – I mean, if you're forced by economic necessity because you're fired, that's one thing. But if you make a choice to do this high wire act, either because you can afford to because you don't have a kid, you don't have a spouse, you don't have a whatever, or because you really do want to do this reinvention thing, it really, in my mind, changes everything. And because my attitude is most people I know who are 30, 40, 50, or 60 – would love to be able to do this. They can't do it because of their own obligations. They can't do it because they're much more worried they won't find another job. They can't do it because they have several kids who are in college at $60,000 a year. So in many ways, you look at at least I look at these millennials with incredible envy that they have, some of them, a lot of them, have the courage and the risk-taking willingness to basically quit. I mean, you know what the question she asked at the beginning of the story is, when is it okay to quit a job without having another one?
Yeah.
You can never imagine having asked that question 20 years ago, because
the
answer then was, never is it okay, and now it apparently is.
Okay, so I think that's very, very interesting. A couple of flashes in response to that. First, I literally just walked out of a conference, an executive conference center at Babson, where I was coaching 60 really bright advertising executives. And we were talking about the millennials in the group and in their workforce who now have this kind of frame and view on work.
Mm-hmm.
And how, and thank you for being so candid, Jim, because someone finally kind of coughed up the candor and honesty and said, I'm actually a little jealous of them, right? That they, you know, take time off in the middle of the day to go do a skateboarding lesson because they're going to work until midnight, but skateboarding is a really big deal for them.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think we really do have an emerging and novel view of work. Second response, to be able to take a gap year and be able to say, okay, I'm going to quit my job and reboot myself, takes means. It takes economic means, right? You can't do that if you have no family. If you have no nest egg, you have no family financial support, you don't have a trust fund, it's very – I could not have done that. My parents couldn't have afforded a gap year for me. I was on scholarship. The scholarship only worked if I went straight on to college. So I think we have to remember that some of this risk-taking possibility, some of this ability comes from a generation that at least in certain zip codes has lived in great prosperity. Right, it's important. This is a very that what part of this is about the prosperity that has fueled some of these young people's rise. And my third response is, you know, and it's again related to the conversation I just facilitated, which I had less to do with than these very, very thoughtful people. And one of the men in the room was talking about how he has completely changed his idea of how his team works together because he has a whole lot of women who have had children, and how in the business in which it's all people and you need to be on all the time and you got to keep the client love train running like advertising, right? You have to be in the office or with the client. You can't be at home working on a part-time basis. Well, that too, that previously immovable tectonic plate has shifted as well. And he said, some of my most productive people, most creative people are women who are now, right, compartmentalizing their work in new ways and coming into the office 3 days a week. So everywhere we turn, work, as we think about it, career making, I think is being, shall we say, in an overused phrase, massively disrupted.
Wait a minute. Don't leave that for a second, because I find that very heartening that in advertising, which, as you say, you've got to be at the beck and call.
24/7.
Exactly. So how do these women that are home with their children part-time and working 3 days a week manage that if you know, Nestle's Crunch calls them or whoever it is at, you know, midnight and wants their attention? How do they...
A lot of what they do is say, I can't talk to you now, but I can talk to you then. So we actually do a whole session on training your clients, right? Like training your team or training your boss that you know, you don't have to answer emails in the first 2 seconds or in the first, you know, 12 hours that they appear. That's a kind of whole nother sidebar.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
I love that.
Oh, yeah. I do a whole section on the power of doing nothing right away. And I tell this story. I'm sorry. You can't have a segment without me talking about Lincoln. Of Lincoln writing this letter, right when he was really, really angry at George Meade after the Battle of Gettysburg because Meade didn't attack Lee on his retreat. And Lincoln writes this really angry letter. It's 3 pages. It's you disappoint me. You could have ended the war. I can't tell you what this has cost us. And he folds it all up and he seals it all up and he writes to George Meade. And then on the back of it, he writes the date. Right, signed but never sent, because he didn't think if he reacted in the minute it would serve him and the country well, because he didn't want to alienate the West Point brass. So I do this whole session on what if you don't do anything right now? What if you don't react right now? What will happen? And so part of what these women that are working, you know, on in limited frames of time do is do their work when they do it, and then they step back. And guess what? What this manager, this executive was saying is it can work really well.
That's wonderful.
I want to get back to this whole moment. I want to get back to the topic at hand just for a second. Yeah. So, you know, we talk about the millennials' political attitudes a lot on this show. And we say, well, when the 25-year-old becomes a 45-year-old, I mean, here's a good – let's, you know, the best example is gay marriage. We talk about a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, over something like even – I think it's 71% of Republican millennials. I may be off by one or two, support gay marriage. When they become the 40-year-olds, the whole debate is over. Not that it's not pretty close to all over right now, depending on what the Supreme Court does somewhere down the line. But on this issue, I say to myself, when these millennials get married, have kids, have responsibilities, are they going to become exactly like us? Or is that willingness to take risks and have these interludes going to stay with them? Because I have to say, the reason I was against this whole gap year thing for my kids and I changed my mind, there is no question that if you step back from what you're doing, I don't care if you're 20, 30, or 50, and take a minute or a month or a year to actually think about it, you're probably going to do better, even if you decide going back to the exact same thing that you did before. So the question is, will it continue as they age, or is it just a function of this group of 18 to 28 years old?
See, I think we will get more of this. I don't think it's primarily – I don't think it's just about youth and means and some kids that have the wherewithal financially to do this. I think it's about really huge shifts in the global, you know, market for work. I really do. I think each of us, including all of us, are roughly the same age, right? Whatever. Yeah. We're boomers. We're all boomers sitting around
boomers.
This table, and lots of our listeners. I think that we will, if we choose to work, and many of us will, choose to work into our 70s, we'll be doing something very different, right, when we're 68 or 72. We'll be doing something very different because the nature of what is demanded by the marketplace and all this uneven growth, right, and not a kind of steady state expansion across the global workplace is going to cause each of us, in some sense, to fit ourselves, not just from the inside out, but partly from the demand for labor outside, inside, to fit ourselves to new marks. As Shackleton would say, a man must fit himself to a new mark when the time changes. Right? We must fit ourselves. I think we'll all be doing a lot more entrepreneurial kind of, not only starting our own business, but entrepreneurial approaches to looking for work, resetting, rethinking, and remaking ourselves. Think about all the people, and I know many of them, think about limo drivers. Almost every limo driver that you're ever with, right, and many, many taxi drivers have at least two other lines of work, right? Most of them never started in any of those lines of work, including driving, right? And they are not just an isolated example. They are about a new economy, right, that demands different things and has more increasingly large amounts of flexibility built in and harshness and less social safety net. Back to our, you know, Nick
Wallenda.
Thank you. Back to Nick Wallenda. And so I think that there are costs to that already, but it will demand more more innovation and instinct and creativity on the part of each individual, and less looking to institutions, government, corporations, you know, large scale companies to somehow figure this out for the individual. I think we'll all be looking more like millennials in 15 years than we can anticipate right now.
I hope you're right.
You know, Nancy Kane from Harvard Business School, we have a question from one of our colleagues, Callie Crossley, who wants to know what about companies like Apple and Google that offer professional sabbaticals.
That's a great question.
Are they more likely to keep millennials in the ranks?
So a couple of comments about both those companies and some other interesting foresighted companies that believe that all they really have for assets are the creativity and innovation of their people. That's describing a lot of parts of the new economy. Yes, they believe this will be attractive to millennials. They also believe it'll be good business because they think that people that go away, back to the point of even like the women stepping away from being on email all the time, or Lincoln not having email and hitting send, George Meade, of course, a world history could have been different, right? They believe that stepping back is actually going to be very good for those people's ability to rethink, re-envision the next Google innovation. You know, Google also has something else in exactly the same spirit. It's part of, again, this new kind of new world of work where I think it's Fridays. Every Friday, you can work on something that has nothing to do with Google stuff on office time.
Really?
Now, you don't tell – they're not doing this like, you know, to like feed your soul. Or if they are, there's the business case for feeding your soul, which is go work on this invention or this gadget or this really new idea about, you know, how you can stream something on the internet. And by the way, chances are that'll benefit Google. Even the program I teach in is all about bring them away from the office, reset them, reboot them, not just for their agency and their teams and their creative product and the kind of, you know, awards they can win at AdFest. Bring them away so they can reboot with themselves, because it's going to help them, and that means it's most likely really going to help their people and their creativity and their clients.
Yeah, I'm going to get back to the non-millennials for a second. If you had I think I can fairly say that between the three of us, I think this is a fair statement, you can't find three people who love what they do much more than we do. Is that a fair?
I would say I'm very
lucky. And Nancy, that's true for you
absolutely.
Too.
Absolutely.
But to take this theme again, if you had an opportunity in 3 years or 4 years to say the thing you've been dying to do that you haven't been able to do for whatever reasons, financial, whatever, or time, you can go do. You could at least take it. Wouldn't that have tremendous appeal to you?
Oh, yes. I think that's one of
the point
things.
Is, I think everybody would like to do this, is what I'm saying.
Journalists used to get, and they get paid for them, I don't know if they still do, the Nieman Fellowship at Harvard or the Knight Fellowship at Stanford, where you go for a year and your company still pays you, the difference between what the school pays you and what the company pays you. So you get your salary and you go for a year to one of the great universities in the world and study whatever you want. I mean, phenomenal, phenomenal opportunity. And people come back, you know, they work on their novel or they read, you know, they read the Divine Comedy, whatever they wanted to do. And it's fantastic. But those opportunities are few and far between.
They are. But I can tell you, as someone who's worked with some of those people and done all kinds of work now on different modes of motivating and sustaining, a lot of this is about sustaining your gifts, right, over time in a very reactive, increasingly 24/7 kind of workplace for lots and lots of people in different industries. I can tell you that the evidence on the results of this in terms of what you go back to or what you return or what you do differently is unequivocal that people are better for this moment, this reset.
Because
this
if you go back, you've decided you really want it as opposed to just doing it because that's what you've been doing.
Exactly.
I mean, it's so obvious to me.
And you go back with a fresh perspective and you go back with how the Divine Comedy matters to this, you know, this very interesting legal case I'm putting together. You go back restored and refreshed and with a different frame. And that is very, very, very important. It's important for leaders. It's important for mothers, it's important for all of us, and we can't all have the luxury of having a gap year or taking a year off or leaving a job because we don't like it or we just want to reboot. We can't all do that. We can build small aspects of this into our lives.
Okay, now in a couple of minutes after Nancy goes, we're going to take your phone calls. If you're millennials, we're going to ask you if you have encountered this kind of situation, if you've become a risk taker, and we're going to ask you if you aren't a millennial, did quitting a job without a backup plan give you the drive you needed to find that next job, or were you too scared to do it? But before, for weeks, Nancy has been teasing us with a poem she wrote long ago about two mothers. Is it
yes,
not? Now,
about,
whose mothers would they be?
Okay, the poem is called Nancy and Iris. It's about Lincoln's mother, Nancy Hanks, Nancy Hanks Lincoln, And Paul Hewson, which is Bono's given birth name, Paul Hewson, Iris Hewson, his mother, just coincidentally, I finished this poem, only really finished it about a month ago. I started it many years ago and didn't feel I could complete it. It was too ambitious for me. I'm not sure if that's right or wrong, but it is completed. And I wrote it because I was so struck by how the effect that each of their mothers each died when they were very young. Surprisingly, unexpectedly, suddenly, and I was very impressed as I read about each of these people in different contexts, how much they were affected by that, and how much their leadership was affected.
Hold on, before you do the poem, what happened to Bono's mother?
She had a brain hemorrhage at her father's funeral. Her father had dropped dead the morning after his golden wedding anniversary celebration with her mother. And he had died in his sleep. She was organizing the funeral. 3 days later, after his death, in the churchyard, she dropped dead. She had brain hemorrhage, and she was on life support for 4 days.
Wow. So she was in her 40s or 50s or something? Wow.
Yeah.
So this is called Nancy and Iris.
It's called Nancy and Iris, okay?
Take it away, Nancy Kane.
They live in the shadows now, placeholders for the past. Terrible it was for each of their sons. The leave-taking so sudden, unthinkable, even as it happened. Nancy's boy ran wild in the woods, feeding on squirrels and Indiana acorns. Savage-like, he and his sister waited for Tom to come back with his gun and his new bride. Before his father left, they had made the box, the boy carving the pegs for the corners while Tom hewed the long slats. Then it was time. She vanished below. The grave, windswept, unresisting, as the panther's scream filled the night and the 9-year-old boy with fear. Across an ocean and the years that piled on toward our time, the son of Iris bounced off the walls in the Dublin house, skirting round the black hole of grief and the blood at the churchyard gate. The hole grew wide and then deep. The weeks became months and then years. His father would not speak of the collapse that became an ending. It had come so quickly, the brain bleed at her father's funeral, 4 days on life support. Her sons called in to say goodbye as Sarah and Abe had stood by Nancy's bedside in an older time. Iris lay immobile while her children crept in, faces drawn. A switch was pulled. He felt the house come crashing down. Cut adrift in space and time, he staggered farther, deeper into his 14th year. From the shadows, each woman looked on as her son tried to walk on. At times, each stumbled into blackness, dark and deep and unrelenting. They both ran from the emptiness, Abe into books, ideas, away out of his father's life. Paul, later Bono, into music, a girl with Spanish eyes. While his father said, "Don't dream." The boys became men and still they ran, recognition, a public stage, pulling them on, the specter of redemption behind the milestones. For Nancy's son, a court case won, the next election, an audition at Cooper Union, right makes might, daring to do our duty. The scene was then transported, and the war came. Sumter, Shiloh, Antietam, Gettysburg, fiery trial. From deep within, a wellspring of compassion and vision. From these honored dead, he found increased devotion to save the Union and change it, transmuting the base metal of his grief, our grief, into terrible, almighty gold, a new birth of freedom, mined at fearsome cost now and then. The son of Iris took up his pickaxe. He had found platinum after chasing record contracts, fans, top of the charts. Now he wanted more, a bigger stage, a broader quest. He dug for justice, debt relief, medicine, music, and politics. Where you live should not decide whether you live or whether you die. Ireland and Africa, Iris inside him, and now in others around the world. Nancy and Iris, do they know, these two women, ripped so early from their sons, what their boys did with all the love? What they still do from the black hole, the shock and awe that was their mother's leaving.
Is that worth the wait,
Nancy Kane?
You are amazing.
God, that was
Nancy
terrific.
And Iris.
Is there anything you can't do over there, Nancy
Kane?
That's what I want to
know.
Well,
thank you. That was a great honor.
That was great.
Thank you, dear readers. Thank you, dear listeners.
That was great. I think we should put that in your next book.
Can we make that available online for people?
Sure.
We will. That'll be available on WGBHnews.org by the end of the day.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you, Nancy Kane. That
Nancy
was breathtaking.
Nancy Kane is an historian at the Harvard Business School, where she holds the James E. Roison Chair of Business Administration. She also obviously is a poet, and her latest book is Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. She joins us every Tuesday. Thank you, Nancy. Up next, we're going to ask you guys, have you quit a job without a backup plan? Was it the best thing you did or something you'll regret? That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.